We'll call this meeting of the House Resources to order at 1:02 p.m. Thank you for joining us. Members present today, Representative Chris Birch, Representative Justin Parrish, Representative George Rauscher, Representative Delana Johnson, Representative Dave Tellerico, our Vice Chair, Representative Dean Westlake, Representative Harriet Drummond's joining us, Co-Chair Andy Josephson, and myself, Representative Garen Tarr. Please let the record reflect that we do have a quorum to conduct business today. Assisting us today is our recording secretary, Ms. Debbie Tillinghast, and our LIO moderator, Summers Cole. Thank you to both of them for our help with our meeting today. Before we go ahead with our testimony from Mr. Ruggiero, if we could please ask attendees and members to silence their cell phones. And today we're going to be hearing from Mr. Ruggiero. His presentation is somewhat short, so we think we'll have quite a bit of time for questions. At this time, this is the last time Mr. Ruggiero is scheduled to be before the committee. So we hope that the opportunity to ask questions of him today, you'll take advantage of that. So if you would please come to the stand and introduce yourself, and hopefully members have his presentation. Looks similar to the previous one, but dated February 29th. I think today is actually the first.
You took away my thunder. They're collector's items.
But thank you so much for being here. And if you, again, would please introduce yourself, and then we'll go through your presentation. As always, we'll do the questions at the bottom of each slide before we go to the next slide.
Okay. Thank you, Chairman Tarr. For the record, my name is Rich Ruggiero, and I'm with Castle Gap Advisors. And, you know, today is sort of as Tarr said, is the last presentation before this committee. And what I wanted to do is go over a message summary of, because you're probably sitting there wondering, this is HB 111. I think it's been asked many times. And I've gone over some things that aren't quite on point to HB 111. And the reason for doing that is what I was hoping to bring to the table is the experience that I've seen in the past that when the controlling bodies jump into an issue that they see right before them, that they tend not to see the whole environment in which that they're operating. And so what I'd hope to have left this committee with is a better understanding of the competitive world in which Alaska is operating and some of the mechanisms that are in place out there. And so, therefore, that when you look into making some fixes to your petroleum taxation system, that you do so keeping in mind what your long-term goals are, what your short-term needs are, and then making sure that what you do is in line with those, as I said, understanding what the rest of the world's doing. If I took a quick look, I think it's been said a number of times, what's happened over the last decade is you've seen an increase in the amount of spending that's in Alaska. You've also seen an arresting of the decline and an increase in production in Alaska. You know, is it appropriate for the amount that was spent? That takes a whole lot more detailed analysis, but you can see to some extent some cause and some effect that comes into this. But as I look at it overall relative to other regimes where I have advised, this is one of the most complex systems with more moving parts than I'm used to seeing in a petroleum taxation system. Just as a general there. As I said, the intent of my first review is to give an overview, and then from that overview, to be able to talk about, which I think is one of the goals that every entity has when they put together a taxation system, is that it has some durability. And I tend not to use stability because some of the most durable systems in the world are the most instable if stable is used to be the number of changes they make. And I think I talked about that in the beginning, that as long as changes are made in a responsive manner to the market and the circumstances, you can have a large number of changes and still be deemed a stable place to do business. You can have very infrequent changes, but have them in the wrong direction, and that can be deemed as very instable. So I tended to use the word durable because durable means lasting for a period of time. So I hope to have put some tools and some thoughts on the table that as you move along as a legislature and consider if there's a need to change some things in your petroleum taxation, that you do so looking at it from a position of durability. And then this is where the whole discussion on looking at self-correcting terms that we've talked about come into play. And so today I'll eventually get to and talk about, I've been asked to give my opinion on the changes in 111, and we'll have that a little later in the presentation. No questions, I'll move on. The slide on page 3 is just repeating what we've had in the previous presentations. As the, I always put the long-term goals on the left, as that's your guiding principles to keep in mind as you look at some of the short-term objectives that are on the right that you need to do. So, you know, clearly like any regime, you're wanting to keep as much production flowing as long as possible. You have the unique aspect of the TAPS pipeline and the connection and that sort of the lifeline to the North Slope, so you want to make sure that you keep that running for as long as possible. Then on the short term, with the low prices, obviously there's low income to the state from petroleum operations, and that creates a challenge for governments such as the state of Alaska, where they depend on petroleum-based revenues for the majority of its treasury input.
We'll do the questions at the end of the slide before you go to the next slide.
Okay. Just some further observations. You'll think this really strange, but the last few nights I've taken the book home with me and I've been rereading this legislation, because there have been quite a few changes since I had studied it, you know, 6-7 years ago. And you can see some overall major structural changes, and then you can see some changes that obviously were made to sort of stopgap an issue that popped up that may or may not have the outcome that people were expecting.
Mr. Ruggiero, I apologize. Can we go back to the previous slide, because Representative Johnson had a question on that slide, and I missed it before you switched to the next slide. Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I believe this is a question I asked before, and so I just wanted, since you address it here, I want to make sure I ask the question again. I haven't really gotten an answer on it. How do you see HB 111 keeping, so looking at the first bullet point under short-term objectives, keep the industry activity and flowing production as high as possible during a period of low to negative margins? And so I was just wondering how you see HB 111 fulfilling that goal.
Representative Johnson, through the chair, I will answer that, and it's actually on a slide that comes up here in about 3 slides.
And if I may
follow up?
Mm-hmm. Okay, so just so while I have this, on this, on the next slide, the last bullet point, which are not quite two yet, I was just wondering if you would, so you said there's an error, so I'm just wondering when you get to that point, if you will just say what it is, when it will be uploaded to BASIS, and where we can get more information on that. So, thank you.
Thank you. Mm-hmm. If I continue, as I said, I looked at it, I've been, you know, and understanding that the whole compendium of the legislation you have was to create a bunch of balances, which I think have been talked about by a number of the industry speakers, you know, big with small, new with, you know, incumbent, you know, North Slope, Cook Inlet. You've got all these different variations in there. And as I said, it's a complex thing. And each time I read the legislation and I go through and I start back referencing through the various pieces, this is where what I did find out is part of my model that I have on the NOL, which I used as an unintended consequence, part of it is correct, part of it is incorrect. And I need to go back in and make the changes based on the reading that I had, which I've now verified with a couple of people in the state, that the new understanding is the way it's being administered. So I do apologize for not having that exactly right the first time, but we'll get it right and we'll present you. I just use that as an unintended consequence. There are other ones that were there, but that's really not the core of the message that I was bringing forward. And this is not to make up for my mistake, but it just shows the complexity of the system that it's very easy for people to step in and not quite put the numbers in the right lines in the right boxes and come up with the same result. And that just means that you have a system here where significant resources are likely being put to the task by both the state to administer it and the oil companies to understand it and also file their taxes within it. And to the question of when we'll have it, as soon as I can put the updated model together and have a chance to breathe here. The legislature as a whole is keeping me busy while I'm here. So as soon as I have a chance to breathe, I'll put it together and we'll submit it to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Ruggiero. And then we'll send an email and just make sure everybody has received that and has it.
In the two meetings on Monday, we talked about an alternative option to what you have in place today. And I just put that forward as a way to show that you could simplify greatly the system that you have in place and remove a lot of these different pieces, different aspects, and worrying about where you put them and where you don't put them, because it would make it a simple revenue minus cost times tax off the table gives a bottom result without having to worry about which credit, where am I at, how big is it, are the limitations on me being able to use it, is it within 7 years or 9 years, the price over 70, not over. It just, we eliminate all of that and get back to something which is very common to anybody in business. It's revenue minus expenses, look at my tax, apply the tax, and go from there. So that was just put up there as a framework to show that what you have can be done much more simply than what you have now. It was not put up as a recommendation that you as a committee do a drastic redo of your taxation system. We're just showing that there are simpler options out there that can be done. And then the next pages get into views of HB 111 when viewed under the strategic framework that Representative Johnson mentioned going forward.
Any questions before we go to the next slide? Representative Burke.
Thank you, Madam Chair. One of the slides that you presented during our work session earlier this week, basically it tracked the current SB 21 with the, I'm trying to remember the step net, and they were basically, if I remember right, they're almost identical lines on the graph as far as the take for both the state and the other. It was that affected by your reinterpretation of the NOL model, or is that graph still stand? I guess.
Representative Bush, to the chair, that model is unaffected. I did check, and the logic that is buried within it, you know, behind the scenes in the black box part of the model, is accurate according to the way the legislation reads.
Okay. I just thought that was very striking that the assessment and the look back, if you will, you know, showed basically identical or, you know, very close to a similar take on both ends. But appreciate it. Thank you.
Any other questions? Okay. Please continue.
Instead of doing a section-by-section analysis, I've kind of grouped the suggested changes in HB 111 into two categories. The first one I put down is increasing taxation. And there are a number of items in 111 that minimize the downside risk for the state at low prices. And that includes the increase in the gross minimum, hardening of the floor, changing the conversion rate on credits, on NOL credits, from 35 to 15, and even the possibility of reducing the per barrel credits going forward. As I have up there, recognizing that the state has a short-term need to shore up its fiscals, there's a desire to increase the state take. And I think one of the things I pointed out a couple times in my first three testimonies, that a lot of times you may sit back and scratch your head and say, why did country X do that and why did country Y do that? And I always, and one of the things about Ford is regimes change their taxes based on circumstances unique to them. And one of those circumstances that you have right now here in Alaska is the one that you're facing on the amount of money coming in to the Treasury and the amount of money going out. And so a decision to change what I have up here, just for an observation, is Alaska increasing its state when the majority of other regimes are lowering them, is not something that would absolutely view Alaska in a good light. However, conversely, if I look at raising minimums, that's akin to raising the royalty. And as we talked the other night, take lower 48. If you're comparing to 30, 40, 50-year-old leases that have the standard 1/8 royalty like you have here, raising it 4 or 5 points would be viewed unfavorable. However, if you're looking at all the new acreage acquisitions where there's huge acreage bonuses and royalties that average 20-plus, you're still on the good side of that if you have a 4 or 5 point increase in the minimum take. The one thing to recognize, though, is in all the petroleum economics and projects that I've run, I've always viewed anything that's a gross minimum, which includes royalty, is like running a 100-yard dash with a hurdle as the first step. And I really can't get going until I get over that hurdle. And all projects have to be able to clear that hurdle before I can start getting to the point where is there then enough profit after that that will give myself as a person recommending something or the committee that's looking at it the comfort that they'll go ahead and agree to make that investment. So I just raise that as you raise minimum takes, you are creating a bit higher of a hurdle that has to be overcome for people to learn to get comfortable to continue to invest here. What I would also ask that you consider is that we possibly, according to a number of people that do the predictions, looking at a prolonged period where we're only in a $50 to $80 an oil range for oil price. And, you know, without a lot of detailed modeling, I can't tell you exactly impacts of X, Y, and Z. But what I can say is if there was one thing I'd ask that you get the administration or others to look at is the impact of what you're doing with the minimum and with the potential changes to the per barrel credits across that range, because that's likely a range that you're going to be in for a number of years. I know there's a whole lot in the industry, including myself, that would love that we'd go back north of 100. But a lot of the other work that I'm doing, the advice that I'm giving is not advice based on thinking about $100 plus oil.
Representative Birch.
Thank you, Madam Chair. When you talk about minimizing the downside risk of the state, I mean, it seems like the ultimate risk would be no production because your royalty share, zero, I mean, you can have 1/6 or an 1/8 interest in no production is basically zero. I'm concerned about that. But also, when you mentioned that the, raising the gross minimum tax 25% to 5% from 4% creates a higher hurdle to investment, I think that's one of the challenges that a number of us, I mean, that I'm hearing from people, just, what are we doing that may compromise our ability to compete in a world market for dollar investments, whether it's, wherever those dollars come from, whether it's new players or existing players. And that is a concern, and I look forward to seeing how that plays forward. But I do see that the real risk as being, the issue of no production, because the royalty share is always going to be there, presumably or largely there.
Yeah. Representative Birch, to the chair, I believe I said this the other night, that you have such long lead times here.
Yeah.
Then I'm going to use a term, you don't want to shut down the investment engine because a cold start is going to take it a long, hard time to happen. So, you've got a balance between the needs that the state has currently with what is going too far that would shut that investment engine down. Mm-hmm. And then you may be seeing a number of years before you get investment coming back, even if you then put in the incentives to make Alaska extremely attractive relative to other regimes. And so, the taxation policy has to go along with, the state needs and the type of production that you've got in the state. Now, the other thing that I would say is, probably the biggest things that you're going to need to look at is you've got, as I understand it, three potential fairly large discoveries. Mm-hmm. And those coming on stream, I would believe, would be very important to the state. And so I think it's a matter of sitting down and making sure you understand what you're doing with your taxation policy and what impacts it's having on those particular projects.
Very good. Thank you. Thank you, sir.
Any other questions? Okay, please continue.
The next one comes down to handling credits. Alaska was very, very unique in offering cash for, first converting NOLs to credits and then offering cash for those credits. But that was deemed something at the time it was done as necessary to attract new investment to the state along with new players to the state. Again, a hindsight look says you did accomplish in getting a number of different players come to the state. But as I mentioned, having worked a couple of bankruptcies related to companies with certificate and cashable certificates involved, it became a very complex and muddied picture. And so just from my observation is I believe you can still attract and you can offer some things that will bring potential investment to bear. But I don't see the need, and I've got a suggestion up here on everyone being able to get cash for their credits. I think one thing that about talking about credits and NOLs is around the world, the norm is anybody who invests has the opportunity to recover their cost. And if in any way you would try and keep some of the operators from being able to recover their costs, and this is cost when they have production ultimately, that would put you at the bottom of the world rankings. Because everywhere else, when they eventually have costs that go to production, they're given the opportunity within a set of rules and guidelines. I mean, it's not immediate. Some it's immediate, others it's over time. But everyone has the right, subject to having the available production, to recover their cost. If there's recommendations I would have, which I was asked to give here, is, you know, I don't understand the need for this NOLs to credit conversion. If it becomes the same, whether I deduct the NOL and apply the tax and then the barrel credits, or I apply the 35 tax, you know, and then the $8 barrel and then subtract the NOL credit, tax credit, and it comes out the same, why go through all that? Why even have that? And so my recommendations up here is for an existing producer, they just carry forward the NOLs and offset it against future taxable income. It's the way it's done everywhere else. There may be a few places that have credits, but usually they're unique credits, like they're additional credits, like your QCE was. It's an additional credit on top of the money spent, as opposed to converting the cost to credits. My next recommendation is if you've got non-producers, but the NOL is created by either exploration, appraisal, or development activity that eventually is going to result in production, that, like almost everywhere else in the world, that carries forward as a cost and then gets recovered from the production revenues in the project. What I have in there is, that's what I talked about, in some locations, those NOLs, in some other regimes, they do receive some degree of uplift to compensate for the time it takes between exploration, appraisal, and then ultimate first oil into a pipeline. And then I have for non-producers where the NOL is created basically by an explorer and the results is a dry hole and they're done. You allow the NOL to be converted to some form of cashable credit at a percentage. But payment of that is subject to a set of prerequisites. Some suggestions on those prerequisites are a definition of what data or information that they collected while spending that money, and in being able to turn that over for the use of the state, ensuring that all their service contractors have been paid, and you not have some private equity firm restructuring the company and leaving the service company stranded. I was on the receiving end of that as Baker Hughes twice. and And then they would relinquish the lease, i.e. they're done working in Alaska. And I've been asked the question in discussion, why would I pay somebody if they're leaving? Well, you're actually paying them for coming. That's what it was. Many people, if they look at the cost of an exploration well in Alaska, if they thought that they were going totally out of pocket the entire amount, they may not take that risk. They may not come. The fact that they were able to say, and by the way, nobody comes to drill a dry hole on purpose just to get a credit for part of their spending. They come to drill the well believing that they're going to have a discovery, and they come believing that there's going to be a future upside for them. So the credits were there as a way to say, we're going to reduce your risk a little bit, and as the state, I'm going to be, again, use this term, an indirect investor in what you're doing. And that was there to bring them to the table up here in Alaska and to do some work. And my last observation is, I realize that you have a bank of credits outstanding that need to be paid, where the state has agreed to those credits. And I'm just saying, if there's a choice to defer those significantly, I would just recommend looking into some degree of uplift for you to determine, which would be available as you pay those credits off over time as funds become available.
Representative Rauscher has a question.
Thank you. Through the chair, Mr. Ruggiero, the last bullet, the hyphenated bullet on the bottom of the page you just mentioned, just your professional opinion is what I'm wondering here, is what do you think the likelihood of them accepting that type of an offer, do you think that's a likely thing to happen?
Representative Rauscher, through the chair.
Because we're going to be trying to redo everything here.
Yeah, I'm pausing a little bit in my answer. I was going to say, what I can tell you is from my experience when I was inside a large oil company, and I've been in both situations where the leadership that I reported to was, we have a deal, stick to the deal, get me the deal that we had agreed to. And I've had other situations where management says, okay, we can work with the government. There's got to be a little bit of give to us if I'm going to give them something back. And so what I can't tell you is how the companies today and their management teams today would respond, but I can tell you I've seen both sides of that coin, where it would be very acceptable to where it be viewed as unacceptable.
And follow up. And thank you very much. I appreciate that. And the third hyphenated bullet in the first set, payable to a person, is that intended? Or is that what you mean, payable to a person?
Representative Rauscher, that's my contract in coming out, where person's defined as whatever the entity is that holds the certificate.
Okay. All right. I appreciate that. I was just looking for a qualification. Thank you.
Yes.
So I just want to go back to some of these recommendations and just sort of talk through them a little bit more. So one of our goals is, making sure that we remain competitive for, the new entrants and some of the companies that might be interested in, smaller opportunities relative to, right, the billions of barrels we've gotten so far. And so when you're talking about, for a non-producer, where the NOL is created, and go into the uplift, I just want you to spend a little more time explaining that and, how that might work. For example, a company that's an exploration company that is not going to go into production, but wants to just be active in that phase of the work, how that might work if that's the opportunity.
Sure, Director. There's a couple things I'm going to, it's a couple different ways I'm going to answer, and let me know if I'm on target with this. I think in your question was, what if Company A comes in, does the exploration, has a discovery, and then it turns over to Company B to ultimately do the development? To me, the NOLs would go with the project, and so they would just move from Company A to Company B, and that would be for Company B to use once they got the field onto production. I think that the second way of looking at that is, you know, since tax is by company, not by project, what if they just bring in partners? And what you can get into is, you know, do the NOLs totally go when you then have the division, and that will, you know, the division of the working interest in the property. And a lot of that can come down to the documentation between the parties when they form the joint venture. Again, I hate to go back, but it's easiest for me to do. I can go back to a number of the joint ventures that I was involved in their creation, and at times we would split everything exactly by the working interest, and there's others where my company was the one who did the early work, and that's when we're in a world of high taxes, and we kept all the tax breaks because we would use them against future income. So it kind of depends on how the entities get together. And again, I'm not familiar whether there are or are not any laws in Alaska that would say things have to work one way or the other. I believe that they'd leave it up to the commercial arrangement between the parties.
And could you explain a little bit more how that would keep us sort of competitive and attractive for the new investment?
Sure, Tar. I think the important thing that I would come with is, as we mentioned, you're going to be at a disadvantage to most places in the world because you have the higher cost structure and the harsher, it just is a harsher work environment from location, timing, etc. You have to overcome that. And the way you've overcome that is with offering terms that are a little bit better than the average are offered around the globe. And within that also have an overall tax structure that is competitive overall in the world. I think you still need to do that, and that's why I say you need to continue to allow the NOLs, and I'm recommending some form of uplift so that way it compensates them a little bit for the time value of money. But at the same time, you can also use uplifts in a way to cause a sense of urgency. Is you can allow the uplifts for a period of time, or you can use, as I talked about before, a lump sum uplift. Which, in the examples I'm aware of, there's a government that would compensate people based on an expected 7-year time frame to get into production. If they could get it on before that, they were a little bit enriched, which was okay because the government then got the production sooner and the revenue from it sooner. Or if it got delayed, then that became pain to the company because they're only compensated up to a certain point for carrying those forward, and then after that, it's their time value loss.
Representative Josephson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Ruggiero, I have two questions. The first is about, you said net operating losses should remain with the project, and I'm trying to figure out how that would work for a seismic company. They would depart from the project, and if you could just sort of hypothesize how it would work in their context.
Representative Josephson, seismic, I haven't thought through that, but what I'd say is, was this a spec seismic shoot in which they then expected to be able to sell data sets of that spec seismic shoot? They would have income. Then you have an offset of the income versus their cost structure going in, and at least for corporate income tax purposes, it's pretty clear how they would handle incomes and expenses and whatnot. From a petroleum tax perspective, I'm not sure how that would be handled.
Follow up.
On the subject of data delivery and transparency, do you envision a system where, what do you envision would be done with the new publicly available transparent information? And I ask that because, I mean, there may be some adjustment in law by some future legislature based on its findings about that information. But you described how most companies wouldn't come up here and invest a lot of money without, intending to really be successful. And that it's sort of that in itself is self-correcting. But I'm just wondering, I mean, some people have discussed a system of approval where the transparency would be there in the front end, I mean, essentially here I'm talking about the quality of the play and whether or not all comers should expect to receive some future benefit.
Yeah.
Or whether the state should assert some sort of jurisdiction or discretion over that.
Coach Gibson, this is your resource, and you're the one granting the rights to the companies to extract that resource. So from a very high-level construct, you're open to putting in whatever requirements you want to put with respect to granting that license to extract. So within your leases, you're free to put what you want in there. Then, that, of course, that's subject to whether or not the companies would agree to it. So the balance in that argument is, one is, it is to your benefit as the steward of those resources to have access to and rights to use any data that's created as a result of activity on your lands. You have to balance that with, there's a degree of competitiveness that some information that's non-competitive can be released and can be compared and can be shown with any loss of competitiveness, but there's other information that has been developed by individual companies, and they would like that to be kept confidential for a period of time. So what you'll see around the globe is what I generally see, especially under countries that have PSCs, is any and all data and any and all derivative works on that data are owned by the state. The state is generally allowed to use as much of that as they need to encourage investors on new acreage, new license rounds, etc., because it's in their best interest that they get highest value on the bid, but also that time and money is not spent doing things when they've already got a bit of an idea of where a good spot is versus where a bad spot is based on all the surrounding data that they have. So this is where you'll find that balance, but generally outside the U.S., you will find that the governments that control minerals, they control all the data.
Thank you.
Follow?
No.
I have another question, if nobody else does right now. You know, and I just want to go back, because this is something we're really considering and make sure we cover in great detail while you're here, this idea of, you know, converting from credits to just doing these carry forward losses. And, you know, again, for a non-producer, if we go that route, how does that situate us relative to other regimes, you know, for the kind of incentives that are available to non-producers?
Chair Tarr, in very simplistic, and again, I'm going to generalize, and there are specifics that somebody can come up with around what I'm about to say. If you're not a current producer in a country or a regime, and you come in, you get a license, and you eventually have a development, you carry all those costs into the production period, and you recover those costs through the production period. If you're an explorer and you have a dry hole, in most places, that's your cost 100%. So by offering a conversion to credit and then those credits to cash here in Alaska, that's the incentive that you are offering that puts you a step ahead or a notch ahead of the other places where a lot of times exploration is 100% loss. Now, in some countries, this is really when there's only producers, is they've gone ahead and allow where they've got project ring fencing. The term is, ring fencing is how a jurisdiction taxes. So they always keep the tax done first within the ring fence. A lot of countries do it by project. Well, as an incentive, they will allow losses on one project to ultimately be used against income in another, which is what you have here when you have ring fencing by operator, is they can take everything that they do in the state, lump it together into that calculation. So if you're comparing generally across the globe, what I've got up is recommended on how to treat somebody who's got a discovery who's ultimately going to be a producer is very consistent. What's up there about being, for an explorer who is unsuccessful to be able to then turn in and cash in his credits, that's the incentive that you're giving to get new players to come up here and explore for new hydrocarbons.
And so, Mr. Ruggiero, from this recommendation, if this were a change that we considered, you don't think that would make us less competitive relative to other locations?
Chair Tarr, in my opinion, no.
Okay. Representative Birch.
Thank you, Madam Chair. When we talk about other investments around the world, other regimes, obviously when you have a lease sale, you're putting your best foot forward, you're putting the data out there, and you're putting everything out there, and you're putting the terms and conditions of the lease and anything that's found. What is the frequency of change after you've got somebody hooked and you've got them invested and they've gone in and they've basically doing what they were asked to do as far as the lease invitation? How frequently does everything change after after discovery, if you will? And that's the concern I have, is that maybe that's just the way it is, but it just seems to me like attract that investment and try to put your lease sale out there and make it look good and try to get a lot of interest and everything. What's in your experience, what is the frequency or tendency of other regimes to just keep mixing it up every year or two on the take?
Representative Bush, for the chair, given the large number of governments I've worked for, the tendency is always there to meddle with the system. And the reason being is every time there's an election and there's a new round of people that come in, there's a different view as to what was done previously, whether it was good, bad, or great. And so there's always this tendency to try and look at things and retrade things. That's why in most of the world, the relationship for the extraction of the hydrocarbon is contractual. But even that has not been honored in some places. When countries come in and say, I've got to have 51% ownership in everything, and so people have to give up what they thought that they had. I could sit here and tell stories about it in particular jurisdictions, but it's not uncommon to find governments meddling or trying to change whatever deal had been done previously. And that's just with the circumstances being very, very different at some point in the future than they were, that all made sense at the time the deal was put together, but don't make sense at some point in time in the future.
Fair enough. Thank you.
Representative Josephson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Ruggiero, I have a document. It's page 24 of a spreadsheet from our tax director, and you don't have it in front of you, but I think you've seen it, and I'll tell you. It shows tax as a percent of gross value at the point of production over a spread of different prices. And it says at $80, the state's take would be 10%. And at $100, it would be 18%. And I guess on your slide 6, where you talk about increasing the minimum tax could create a larger hurdle, you said the first step would be a hurdle, and I appreciate that comment. But is the system we have relative to other systems, which I know are generally gross, in the $60 to $100 range, where we see the tax as a percent of GVPP as 4% at $60 and 18% at $100. Is that in your mind fair to the state of Alaska?
Well, Co-Chair Joseph, it's hard for me, I'm just going to be honest, it's hard to say what's fair to the state and what's not fair to the state. What I can tell you is that where that stands, I think, is very favorable relative to other regimes where they invest. So if you're talking about an $80 world and only a net 10% tax, granted that lumped on top of that is royalty and state corporate income tax, federal corporate income tax, you get an overall non-operator take that is very competitive. Whether that's fair to the state or not, that's not for me to decide.
Okay, thank you.
couple other questions here, and I'm just thinking maybe we should do the last slide because then I have a couple of just general ideas that you've talked about that we haven't considered again.
Thank you, Chair Tart. Yeah, this is my last slide. It's not specific to 111, but I think, again, looking at what I've looked at in the last 2 weeks, the conversations that I've had through the hallways in the last week since being here, and what I've talked about is, and the other pieces and the other bills that have been introduced both in this chamber and the other with respect to oil and gas is, these are just the things I would leave you with. You know, stay within that tax, because I think you're most competitive when you're taxing profitability, not taxing revenue. Stay with the ring fencing by operator. That's a very, very hard thing to change. And again, that would add degrees of, if you went to ring fencing by project, that would add degrees of complexity to an already complex system as it is. Simplify where you can. And then, as I talked about, if you're going to use any form of sliding scale or reference to something, my suggestion is you reference it to margin and not to price. And last one that we talked about, this is your asset. You're granting the license for others to come in and to bring their money and their expertise to extract the hydrocarbons. You can establish whatever data program that you wish to have.
Thank you. Representative Rauscher has a question.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Through the Chair, Mr. Ruggiero, could you explain the establish a comprehensive data transparency program as you see it, so you understand what you're talking about there?
Mm-hmm. Representative Rauscher, the Chair, there's been a lot of discussion about this body and the legislature as a whole could probably make a more informed decision if it had more information, more disaggregated information in order to make its decisions. There are other regimes in the world that are would make this look opaque here. I mean, there's a lot of data that gets transmitted, but the availability to this body to be able to make its decisions, it's quite opaque relative to other places around the globe. And so my only suggestion is, I know there's been a lot of comments that I don't have the data, but you've got the ability that in granting future licenses to make sure that you get that data availability, or if you're going to be granting credits or uplifts or incentives or things like that, to the extent that you believe it's important enough, you can attach some data transparency to the granting of those giveaways.
A follow-up,
Representative Rauscher.
Thank you, through the Chair. Do you think that some of the data that we're not getting is because it compromises their competitive edge?
Representative Rauscher, to the Chair, as a private for-profit company, I'm only going to give up as much as I have to, because everything can be and will be used against me in the competitive world. So I will only give up what I have to. But again, if you step back and I say take the 100,000-foot view, a lot of governments have found that they can actually optimize what's going on in their country. They can minimize the cost for facilities and other entities because of that knowledge. But at the same time, and again, I'm back to a personal experience, I would walk into one of those governments, and here was my proposed development plan, and the reservoir engineer would go, you want to drill here? No, you don't want to drill there. You want to drill your first well over here. So in actuality, the government having that data actually helped me as well. So there was a bit, you get the bit of that uncomfortableness that you're giving away competitive advantage. But on the other hand, I've seen the governments that have all that data have actually increased my competitive advantage because they've helped me make sure I spent my money where it was best spent.
Okay, thank you.
Representative Westlake.
Yeah, thank you. And through the Chair. Oil and gas is in my house district, that's my bread and butter. That and mining, both of them. So I'm listening to this whole thing, and it's extremely complicated. I mean, I've looked at the idea for dry holes. I think that's brilliant. And I look at the tax structures that we had before, where inadvertently we've hurt ourselves in some of the tax credits we did. Now, I don't blame the legislators in front of us. They've acted like we are now with the best information that they had in front of them. So revisiting this is certainly needed. Now, as I look at all the opportunities we have to address it, would it seem to be better to be doing this incrementally where house districts like mine wouldn't be hurt, or are we trying to do something that's just totally something for now, and then other legislators past us are going to have to visit it again? Like you said, it's a moving target always, and then we always want to optimize that. So would your take be to just try and do a bulk package now, or work on this incrementally? What would you think of the whole situation there?
Representative Westlake, to the chair. Personally, if I had my druthers, I'd say take on the work and fix it and make it simple. But I know it's not that easy to do. You have to have the political will. You've got to have the time. There's a whole host of things that I don't control. Mm-hmm. But if I was to give you a recommendation from afar, it's simplify. And as you simplify, build in the durable and self-correcting pieces so future legislatures and future resource committees aren't sitting there talking about this piece of it or that piece of it or that piece of it.
Thank you.
Can you follow?
Yeah.
I wanted to ask on that self-correcting portion of it. That's something we haven't spent a bit of time on. But your idea about getting rid of the credits and then just doing them as carry-forward losses, that helps that a little bit be self-correcting in that it's more responsive to actual costs. Is that true?
Chair Tar, apologize. Long time sitting here. What I see is when you convert NOLs to a credit at a percentage, you don't know what relation that will bear to the tax rate at the time when they're actually used. And so if you just carry forward NOLs, they will be used at whatever the effective tax rate is at the time when they're used. And then therefore, as a legislature or as a committee, you don't have to guess what that's going to be, because I can probably say with some accuracy, the guess is going to be wrong. I don't know if it's going to be wrong high or wrong low, but it's going to be wrong. And so it's probably best that you don't do things like that where you try and predict the future, is let the future be what it is. And just let the numbers flow through just as they do on their corporate taxes. Yeah, let's take when they do their corporate income taxes and you have a carry forward loss. Obviously, it's created in a year where your net tax rate is zero because you got the carry forward loss, unless you got AMT, but I don't want to get into all those little things. But necessarily, your effective tax rate when it's created is zero. And you don't know what their effective tax rate is going to be and if there's any graduation in corporate taxes, et cetera, at the time that they actually use it. So you just be guessing. So it's my recommendation, do away with credit, just allow, as the legislation does, losses to be carried forward and then used at a time when there's income to be offset with those NOLs.
And because, again, we just want to make sure we talk about this in extensive detail, can you just sort of explain, what you mean by when you carry it forward and it's going to be applied at the effective tax rate? Sort of just explain that in a little greater detail, because I don't want to suppose that any of us know what you're talking about.
Yeah, sure, Car. You've got a system right now that is this 35% base but with negative progressivity. And as Coach Joseph just pointed out on that chart that Ken Elper had put forward, I think at $60 that was a 7% effective rate. At $80 a barrel it was a 10% effective rate. At $90 a barrel or $100, it got up to around 14% effective rate. And so when you convert something today, you don't know if it's going to be 1 year, 2 years, or 3 years. If you've got a major development, you're going to be accumulating some very large NOLs. And if you convert them to credits, it may be several years down the road before you use them. And if you don't know what the price is going to be, you know, certain things get used at different effective rates and get converted, and you don't know what the absolute tax rate is going to be in the future. You know, what if someone changes that base tax rate from the 35 in a future legislature? So as not to create any potential differences in the future, just why make it any different than they have it on their corporate income tax? Just carry it forward as a loss. Use it when it comes up.
Are there any questions about that? Because that's something we're seriously considering, and I'd want to make sure we cover it extensively, so won't be surprised.
If I could just supplement, Chair Tari.
Okay.
In a production sharing contract, that's exactly how it works. I mean, they don't call them carry forward losses. They're just unrecovered costs, and they get carried forward as costs. They aren't converted to anything else. And ultimately, when there's enough cost oil in the system, they get to recover those costs. And then anything after that is deemed profit oil. And then whatever the split is on the profit oil, that's how that then is distributed between the parties.
And so I just want to sort of announce sort of what we are considering based on these recommendations is, you know, the elimination of cashable credits. And that's been something that was, you know, part of our original bill and idea moving forward, because remember, the way we offer these show up in two places. You know, the ones we write the cash for are an expense side of our sheet, and then the ones used against tax liability show up on our revenue side of our sheet, you know, as just a reduction in revenue. So what we would be doing is, you know, eliminating the side here where we have to write a check for it, and transferring that to the side over here where it would be reflected as a reduction in the revenue we would receive. But it wouldn't wouldn't sort of take effect, if you will, until that company became a producer, because we would remain a net profits tax system. Once the company became a producer, then that loss would be deducted against any of their profit prior to applying our tax rates to it. We're okay with that concept. Okay. Very cool. Something else you've talked with us about is some additional steps for approval, so we can have a little better understanding of sort of what money is being spent and making sure that good investments are being made, and just in terms of, you know, having a little bit of protection. We've considered ideas such as, you know, plan of production, plan of development, you know, at those particular pinpoints in the work as it goes along. You've talked about some of your other experiences and the meetings you've had. Could you just spend a few minutes, you know, sort of explaining some of those different experiences you've had from the professional work you've done, and just give us a sense of how that might be something for consideration that's, you know, not related to the tax rate or the credits, but just might help us make sure that however the state is participating as a co-investor, we're investing in the, you know, the most strategic ways.
Chair Tar, I'll start off by saying I don't know what already takes place in Alaska, and I don't know what DNR or AOGCC or others have as reviews. I know there's basic environmental and whatnot reviews, but I think what we talked about on the side was my experience in the North Sea with three countries there, that the projects that we took forward, there would be 3 to 5 reviews before I got my approval to develop. And those reviews would have every agency of the government that was impacted involved, from reservoir engineers that were in the petroleum directorate, to people out of the treasury on finance, because obviously the investments were going to impact, you know, flows coming from other operations that I had. And the first review would start out when I got scoping fit plus or minus 50% estimates of what I thought I was going to be able to develop and how many wells and what size platform, all the way up to very detailed analysis with plus or minus, you know, 5 or 10% AFE grade estimates for moving forward, such that when I made my formal submission for approval to develop, it was just a rubber stamp exercise. And any issues, any concerns were ahead of time. And this is where I would be challenged with respect to the size of the structure I was putting in. You know, did I have enough drilling slots? Should I have extra? Should I have fewer? You know, what pipeline was I going to go down? And had I had those commercial discussions? All those type of things would be discussed. And that was, it was always the government's way of looking at and making sure that what was being done was optimum from a cost standpoint and was going to get the most hydrocarbon out of the ground. Now, it there was a bit of scheduling, i.e. the governments would influence slightly the timing of Project A versus B versus C, but it would never be a surprise because you would learn that very early on in your review process of where you stood and what they wanted to come on first and where you fit into the process. So you could manage your partnership, you could manage your executives with respect to when something was going to happen. I just recently concluded a deal, a 25-year deal in Asia, and it was over a period of 12 months. I had to get through five stage gates with the government, and at each of those, again, we had the type of reviews to where they got comfortable with the development plan, the amount of money I was spending, where I was drilling, and what my expected, and they knew exactly how much money I was planning on spending, what production I was expecting to get, and how that was going to impact their operations overall. So that I bring that up because it's a process where, in then making a decision on, I should say on the one in Asia, I was negotiating my contract at the same time I was having these reviews. And I can tell you the dialogue within those reviews helped me get terms in that contract that they might not otherwise have given me because we had these detailed reviews and they were able to understand what I was planning on doing and what my needs were as opposed to what my wants were.
And as a follow-up, in your experience, have there been governments that said no to something, you know, at one particular phase of this review because it was not going to be a prudent decision? And did you then have the opportunity to reevaluate and come up with an alternative proposal for consideration?
Chair Tarr, absolutely. Don't have enough fingers and toes to count the number of times I was told no about something. But no is good because it starts to define where the boundary line is. And then if you're shooting in the, I use this, if I go into a dark room and I have to hit something, I'm shooting in the dark, I don't know if I got any chance of hitting it. But at least if somebody starts defining where the fence line is or the boundaries of what I can do, I then know what the parameters are that I need to develop what I'm doing. So sometimes that also allows the companies to push back a little bit on the government thinking. You know, in one locale in the North Sea, was trying to do a very low dollar development, but they had had a requirement at that time that every platform had to have the ability to have someone live on it. And we were going to ask to be a non-manned, remote, you know, solar run, et cetera, platform that just had a helideck and a well. And that was something we had to get special approval, but we were able then to convince the government as well. So it works both ways. They can give us boundary conditions that tells us we need to reshape what we're doing. But at the same time, it was always a process that allowed us to bring forth the innovation, the technology and whatnot that we thought we could add to and get them to change some of the rules and the requirements that they otherwise had had in place.
Final follow-up on this for me. Were any of those approvals requirements to be able to use credits or use, you know, any of the, I know you've said it's very typical that a regime allows for recovery of costs, but through this approval process, was there any other linking that approval process to access to incentives or other investment from the country or regime you were working with?
Sure, Tara. Whatever was in place as the petroleum fiscal system, once I got approval, then I had to do everything within that petroleum fiscal system. There was one project, which was basically the Trinidad LNG project, where there were things particularly linked to it because of its size, because of the capital commitment, and because of the need of what I'm going to call the company fiscal stability that was needed for the first 10 years to get over the risk of developing such a project at the time it was developed.
Any other questions? Representative Birch.
Thank you, Madam Chair. You mentioned a 25-year agreement. How did that go? I mean, is it 25 years? Does it get revisited periodically? Is it a contractual arrangement, or how do you get that length of time without, you know, with some durability or stability in either case?
Representative Bush, the Chair, it is a contractual agreement.
Good. Thank you.
Any other questions from committee members? Yes, Representative Teller.
Just back on page 3, where you've got our long-term and short-term objectives, those are listed via priority, bullet point, most important to least important on those lists.
Representative Tallarico, they're listed in my order of priority.
Okay.
Recommended priority on those.
Okay, thank you. I just wanted to know that for sure. Thank you.
Anything else? I think what we'll do then is take an Eddie's until Co-Chair Tarr returns, and we'll let you know in just a matter of a couple minutes where we're going for the remainder of the 45 minutes. We're at ease.
Not done with Mr. Ruggiero, although he someone has called him out of the room.
I'm back on.
Thank you. And I know Representative Rauscher had to step out, and we'll be back, and then I think Representative Drummond just ran across to her office. Apologies, I just need to step out for a moment. I have a couple other questions. One of the things we've talked about are some of the other, we have the per barrel credit and the GVR as other sort of incentive opportunities. And just want to get your feedback on, you know, the interplay of changing from doing the cashable credits to just losses that carry forward, and whether, you know, you think making that change should influence how we think about either of those things.
Chair Carr, good question that I don't have a ready answer for.
Okay.
I'd really have to think about the interplay. I don't think there's an interplay between the two, but it does bring dynamics of, if you have a GVR and you've got the per barrel, how much of the per barrel credit do you use? And I know you've had that issue of migrating of the per barrel credits, but also how much of the NOL that you use? Is it only up to the point where the minimum tax takes effect? Or do you have to use it all to get to zero and then the minimum tax applies, or only you take it down, you take your PTV down only to the point where it equates with whatever the minimum tax is? I mean, when you have all these moving parts, you get all these different questions as to how the different aspects interplay between each other.
And as a follow-up, though, in your recommendations, you know, where you did the bracketed looking at the profit margins, you know, under that scenario, you thought then you could eliminate some of those other provisions, because then, you know, you're not using the incentives to make it more attractive. You're taxing based on profitability, so it sort of changes that dynamic.
Chair Tarr, with the option that I showed the other night, you take away all these levers. They don't exist and they don't need to exist, and you can actually create the same effective tax rate that you have with all the levers, not needing any of these levers, and then therefore you don't have to worry about migrating, how much carries, how much is this or that. You can just do your tax based off of, again, the simple income minus allowable cost. Go to the tax table, you're done.
Okay.
Follow-up,
Representative Josephson, or question, Representative Josephson?
Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair. So is the benefit one of, along with reducing complexity, that it's easier to audit, it's easier to understand, or how would you describe that benefit?
Coach Josephson, exactly as you just described it. Audit should be orders of magnitude easier. Filling out the form by the company should be orders of magnitude easier in getting it done. It's just what you do is you eliminate a lot of administrative cost out of the system, and you eliminate a lot of what can become clashes between companies and governments as you try and debate, was it supposed to be used that way or supposed to be used that way. By simplifying the system, you greatly reduce the number of friction points that you can have into the future.
And on that, you know, if you, you know, simplify sort of the audits and sort of simplify the payments, then if it's, you know, thinking of a company that's looking at the long lead time necessary to invest in a new project, does it give a higher level of confidence because you're not so worried about what the economics look like because of the price volatility? Because, for example, things like the per barrel credit right now, you know, we have based on, you know, the price per barrel. And so if you're looking to invest for 7 years and then looking for something, you know, and you're looking at the economics 10 or 20 years after that, I guess you have to figure in all of the sort of variability that might occur in the price going forward to actually figure out the economics for that project. If we remove some of those triggers that just then, you know, basically move it over to looking at the profit margins, does that make it easier on a company looking at an investment decision?
Chair Tart, what I can say it does allow, it allows a much simpler economic model to be put together. And by much simpler economic model, that means you have less chance of getting something input incorrectly that might give a wrong answer. And all you have to do then as a company, and all companies have their price forecasts, that if you've got a simple model based off of, as I said, a base rate and some bracketed, you put in your expected production curve, you put in your expected cost, you put in what you believe to be your price forecast, and it becomes a very predictable model. And the only thing that you then do worry about is, because this is legislated, it would be legislated based, is you just have to worry about whether or not future legislatures would change the tax rates at the various bracket points.
Mm-hmm. Representative Parrish.
Thank you, Madam Chair. You know, we spent a very informative hour and a half together, and I thank you again for that yesterday. I'm still somewhat leery of net systems because they don't incentivize cost savings on the part of the company as clearly or as well as do gross production systems. And gross systems also have the advantage of being significantly easier to administrate because we can see how much oil flows through the pipeline. Is it feasible to create a potentially a bracketed gross system with tied to price, which would approximate the current tax environment for the oil companies, or are gross systems just going to be inherently more punishing for these actors or those actors? And in a gross system, how would we need to level the playing field for non-producer new entrants?
Representative Parrish, the chair, tackle the two questions. The first one is, could I build a gross system that would mirror the net system? I can, and it will last and will be accurate only for so long as the cost structure didn't change underneath it. The minute the cost structure changes, then you're getting results different than what you're trying to model. And the one thing that we do know, that it was from one of the charts that I copied from Ken Elper and the administration, we've seen sort of the all-in transportation OPEX, CAPEX numbers change from plus or minus 15 to up over $40 a barrel in just 10 years. And if you tried to build a gross off of where you're at today, the only thing, again, in a few years you'd be grossly wrong, and you'd be fixing it again. And then your second question, if I remember it in here, getting old, was about, does gross help level the playing field between small and large players?
Mm-hmm. Actually, it was, under a gross system, what could we do to level the playing field?
Representative Parrish, Chair, that one's going to have to take a little more thought.
There's no rush.
That's something I'll have to think about. I'm such a non-gross fiscal system person that, you know, trying to think through, if I were in a, you know, growth system, how would I do something? It's going to take me a little time to sit back and think about that.
Follow-up, Representative Parrish.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My concern with NUT systems is we do, to some degree, create a perverse incentive. If a, generally we're finding is a profitable business, and that those profits are made and typically kept in Texas, is just too bad for us. It does allow a externalization of value. For instance, even not making much of a profit in the state of Alaska, even with some losses in the state of Alaska, the production realized within the state of Alaska can result in greater profit for a company. It's just profit that we're not able to touch. So I guess my interest is trying to line up the incentives in such a way as we would not incentivize the significant increases in costs, which you just alluded to, almost a tripling in costs over the last 10 years, which under a NUT system are, well, some of those are borne by the state. Some of them are borne by the federal government through the form of reduced tax revenues. How can we mitigate that from where we are?
Representative Parrish, the chair, one thing that I'm going to go back, and I keep referring to some of the things that I brought up before, is every system, no matter which one you choose, has some pros and some cons. You've just raised one of the cons of a NUT system. I mean, there's a lot of pros that go with it, but one of the cons is, you know, can oil companies gold plate? Now, what I do know from my past, you don't last very long in a lot of these oil companies if your cost structure is way high, because, you know, as a manager within that, you've got personal metrics and goals to make sure that you're only spending as much as you have to, regardless of a government that may give you 60% back, you know, as you know, through the deduction of the cost. But also, that's where I brought forth that all the countries that do that, the way that they manage that problem or mitigate that risk is through these more detailed review processes. And they've got the ability, when they're doing that with every operator on every project, they can take what I'm learning over here and ask that question of the next group that they go talk to. And that helps the government in that case build up the confidence that the amount of money that's being spent is a prudent number. We talked about the numbers here tripling. That could be all prudent. You know, the best, you could have put the best minds, the best people on it, and those costs still would have escalated. When you've got oil prices that went to the level that they did, I can tell you as an executive of a service companies who get squeezed tremendously quickly when the prices go down, they take the opportunity when the prices are up to fill their bank accounts back up a little bit, in fairness. So under, seeing those costs go up like that as the price escalates is not unexpected.
Follow-up?
I think re-raised one of your key points, that one of the most glaring deficiencies of our system is that we can't look from one operator to the next and see where they're where some might be charging more than others, because it's just the other day we had an executive tell me that essentially the taxes they paid last year were not really my business. Although later I went online and saw that they did report that information to Britain, and that the taxes they paid in the state of Alaska were something that they were willing to tell the British government, and the British government then made available. So what can we do within the state of Alaska to hold them to the same standard of disclosure?
Representative Parrish, to the chair, a That's why my very last bullet on my, or sub-bullet on my very last slide is, you're the stewards of the resources, and as you move forward with offering leases, it is in your purview to put into that lease agreement whatever requirements. In addition, if you're going to offer incentives of some form or fashion beyond basics, you can choose to tie some requirements to those as well, if you so wish to do that. But it's a matter, just this is the nature, as I said, I would not disclose anything more than I had to, because I never know when a piece of data is going to help me or hurt me. So I'm only going to give up that which I have to give up. I think as a legislature, you need to sit back and say, am I getting enough information to make well-informed decisions? If the answer is yes, okay. If the answer is no, then it's within your purview to take the steps to try and get what you feel you need to have to make the best decision.
Follow-up?
Thank you, Madam Chair. A lot of the leases that we have, in fact, our most important leases are long established. The agreements that we've entered into are long established. Moving forward, perhaps, on some of the newer leases, we could write in such a stipulation. But it sounds to me that in the absence of a new lease or a lease coming up for renewal, and in the absence of a new agreement or an agreement coming up for renewal, our hands are a little bit tied with the established leases and established agreements. Is that correct?
Representative Parrish, yes.
Thank you.
Representative Tallarico.
So I guess to some degree, when we talk about data and everything, we do get an overall number. And I know in other tax systems outside of oil and gas, say, for example, I have experience with a municipal tax system. And it's not very unusual for us to keep individual tax payments as proprietary information for a particular amount of time due to the fact that the nature of the business, the competitive nature, let's use the overnight accommodations business, that there were definitely rules set in place so that these people weren't, that information wasn't shared with their direct competitors. So I think probably to some degree, as we collect that type of information, wouldn't there always be, I'll call it a grace period, but isn't there always a cushion there so that we're not directly providing? And you know, we talk about some of the data we need. I guess we need to have good data discussion, us being citizen legislators. There's nine of us sitting at this table. I don't know how many have operated drills and been tool pushers and things like that. So I mean, there's a particular amount here where we really have to admit that the expertise of DNR and AOGCC is going to have to be relied on. Mm-hmm. Working with those producers, because so that it's probably a question that a lot of us have. We talk about data, but what level are we talking about? You know, and that's probably something that we need to decide. Really, I'm not trying to put words in your mouth, but I think that's what you're telling. I mean, we'd want to be careful saying, well, we need the nuts and bolts right down to the last time you guys changed a drill bit, and did you use a tricone or did you use a diamond edge bit? And I might say that at this table, and I might have several people scratching their heads saying, I don't know the difference between a tricone and a diamond edge. So that he does, yeah. So there's there is probably, you know, we could actually bury ourselves with data that without serious education, it'd be very difficult for us to determine, you know, when we talk about expenditures and things like that. So there, what I'm saying, I think there's a particular amount of trust that we have to have in the Division of Oil and Gas and AOGCC and those people working directly with those producers. So and you know, I mean, they bring us information as well, and that's valuable information. Maybe we just, so we need to know that we actually evaluate that information that we're given by our own people.
Representative Tallarico, I agree with everything you're saying. An example I would give is we don't need to know whether it's tricone or right. Diamond, etc. But, for example, when I was here 10 years ago, we almost double the recovery off the North Slope and arrest the decline if we just spent a certain amount of money. But there was no detail as to what type of work that was talking about, how quickly would that come. You know, would it come with a big spike and a quick decline, or would it be something that evolved over a period of time just to maintain rate? And so in moving forward, you just said there's a few billion barrels that could be had for several billion dollars. But whether or not that made sense, and what did the state need to do to give the oil companies confidence that they could make those investments and deliver that production and make a return on it? And you didn't know what that exactly represented, so you really didn't know how to adjust things, if you were to adjust anything, to make sure that you encouraged that and brought that additional production online. So it's that type of information that I believe that you need. And as a state, I don't know if it's public or whether it's just, you know, confidentially through agencies like the DNR and AOGCC, to where then you can rely on them when they come in and testify that they've looked at it, they think this is viable, they would recommend the following. But somewhere the state, I think, needs to understand that, so that way prudent decisions can be made relative to the taxation system you've got in place to make the right things happen.
Follow-up, President Tallarico?
Thank you, Madam Chair.
And I just wanted to ask as a follow-up then to that, I do see a difference between what we would need and what the public needs. I don't think a lot of my neighbors would spend time going through details or reports or anything like that. But I have always felt sort of like I didn't have enough information to fully understand what was happening. And, you know, for these very reasons, and part of the challenge is that if you say regarding taxes, for example, yes, the DOR folks are seeing that information, but because it's privileged, even what they can glean from it can't be shared with us. And so that's sort of the breakdown and transfer of information as I see it. They may recognize that there's something deficient or a problem, and you know, they're unfortunately sort of hamstringed in terms of what their ability would be to change it, because I guess they could propose a change, but they couldn't say it was due to circumstances observed through, you know, tax returns or something like that. And so that's sort of how I see it. I mean, does that seem sort of consistent with what you're suggesting, that it's more the policymaker feel, you know, need to be better informed, you know, to sort of bridge that gap, versus I know some folks, and, you know, there's also some other bills out there that are more just a suggestion that the overall amount of incentives or credits or something that were offered would be reported publicly, because, you know, that's a sort of different thing, because that's the public and the state dollars, and so we're all sort of collectively investing in that way, versus, you know, a little more detailed information that we might need to say, oh, okay, well, now I understand how this works better, and I can see why X, Y, and Z are necessary or not working in the way we intended.
Chair Tara, there's a question I had that was never really answered when I was here advising the administration before, as to why everything to do with oil and gas was 95% of it was presented by the Department of Revenue, where they do have a confidentiality obligation because the information when they receive it is part of tax returns. You have a DNR, and everywhere else where I really worked, the equivalent of the DNR is the one that has the information on the production, the spending, right down the line. And it is that entity that usually comes in and talks about what is going on, what has happened, and what's anticipated to happen. Because if the DNR has it, unless it is within, again, some statute in a form like interpretive seismic that might be kept confidential for 10 years or something like that, they're usually the ones that can come in and talk about production data because they got it not as part of a tax return. But if you got the tax director here and you're asking about production disaggregation, he can't give it to you because it's data he got from a tax return, not from the DNR. And so I never understood that the first time I came here, and I still don't understand why you don't rely more on the DNR and the information that they have to come in and give you that disaggregation that you're looking for, so that way you can make a better informed decision.
And as a follow-up to that, we had an amendment last year on our House Bill 247 to try and address this, and it was done in the form of signing a confidentiality agreement. This would be for policymakers, not necessarily giving new direction for DNR folks, but for us it was, you know, sort of confidentiality agreement, documents can't be removed from the room, no photos, all of that type of thing. I mean, does that seem consistent with a level of sort of security around that type of information that's necessary? Should we, as a policymaker, seek to have better access?
Chair Tarr, however you can get access, even if it means you can't tell anybody, that's better than not having any at all. And so I think the whole thing on data is just looking to make sure you have the best information so you can make informed decisions. And what route has to take, I'm sure there's a lot of history, there's a lot of rules, there's a lot of regs, the things that you'll need to work through in order to get to whatever it is that you feel you need to have to best make your decisions.
Was there a question over here that I missed? I missed you. Sorry. Representative Josephson.
Thank you, Representative Tarr. Mr. Ruggieri, you described how the lease expenditure and transportation components were $15 when you were here a decade ago, and now they're more than, they're like 150 times, 150% more. And I guess what I'm wondering is, you've sort of described why, that they rose with the price, presumably several years ago. Why haven't they fallen with the price? Is it because is it because production's down and it's more costly? Each barrel's more costly. I mean, why is it stuck at $40 and why hasn't it fallen back?
Commissioner Jefferson, the chart you were looking at that Ken has, mm-hmm. I think it did show from 2014 through to 2015 that the numbers did fall. So as the price of oil came down, there's always a lead lag between the movement in the price of oil and the movement in cost. But you do see that the companies have gone through reductions. They've gone through belt tightening. Around my wife works for one of the major oil companies, and her budget sure got slashed. So it's happening everywhere. But why doesn't it go down as far as the price of oil went down? Is that's because you've got some fixed components that are not tied to the price of oil, like salaries and benefits. You know, you don't cut those in half when the price of oil gets cut in half. And so those stay fixed, and those continue to grow with time and with inflation. So you really have to, you know, some places will fall faster than others or fall further than others on a relative basis, and that has to do with the fixed variable nature of their business. It also has to do within the fixed how much of it is truly impacted by the price of oil and how much isn't. So you really have to do an analysis of what's there to best understand why it did or did not fall further.
Thank you.
Wrapping up here, I do have one other question I want to make sure we cover. Because, for example, you know, we're considering a change to the per barrel credit, which results in an effective increase, a tax increase on if we look at the effective tax rate. After all, everything's in. But when we look at the chart again provided by the division director, and that was at a variety of, you know, Senate Bill 21 tax calculations at different prices, and there's a little bit of mistake in the math here. So, for example, at $80 right now under current tax, it's an 8.4% tax. And if we make some adjustments that, you know, maybe put us more like at the 10%, right? So, you know, if we make that adjustment and the per barrel credit, that's how we could essentially accomplish that. You know, does that still keep us competitive? So it would represent a tax increase because that's what the overall effect of that change in the per barrel credit would be. But I'm just looking, for example, under our current system, at $80 we're at 8.4%. At $100 we're 16.5%. You know, I really want to focus in minimizing the downside risk and then looking at, you know, sort of this lower price environment that we think we'll be operating in. And I think some folks feel like we need to, you know, maybe the state needs to earn a little bit more if this is sort of the new normal, and that might be why, you know, you'd make this modest adjustment at maybe 1 to 2 percentage points different. But again, with our long-term goal of remaining competitive and keeping investment, you know, how does that position us just sort of picking that $80 mark?
Chair Tarr, it's always the classic, where's the tipping point? You know, where can I sneak an extra nickel in before that last nickel is the one that absolutely stops the investment and stops the new oil flowing. It's going to be different for different companies, and there's going to be different reasons why it happens. I do, you know, will it make you uncompetitive, totally uncompetitive? No. It's a minor movement. Is it a large sum of money on an annual basis? Yes. And that won't go unnoticed. So where's the tipping point? Where's the balance? I think this is where, why it's good to have those competing goals up there. You want to keep oil flowing down taps as long as possible and put as much in there. But at the same time, you've got the short-term challenge of how do I work with a treasury shortfall that you're dealing with right now. And so that becomes a challenge on where you choose to act within both of those somewhat conflicting goals.
Any other questions before we wrap up today? Okay. Well, I just want to sort of announce to the committee some of the ideas that Mr. Ruggiero has presented with us that are under consideration. For example, the change, again, you know, getting rid of the checks that the state would write out and switching that to a system where all the losses carry forward. It would, you know, there wouldn't be a percentage attached to that because it would essentially match the effective tax rate. Data transparency, seriously looking at improvements to that, both perhaps on the public, but on our side of it, as well as some of these sort of stage-gated approaches that have been discussed. So just want to sort of announce that as those were options for consideration, those are some of the things that we're considering, as well as some of these recommendations about how to remain competitive and really evaluating whether House Bill 111, as proposed, has done anything that's too aggressive. And you know, you highlighted the very challenge we face of you know, making sure we have that balance, sort of shifting into the what would have been considered when we passed Senate Bill 21 and oil was $94 a barrel, you know, $60, which we haven't even hit in the last couple of years, you know, was considered a low price at that time, but if we would get to $60, we would all be cheering loudly. So just sort of recognizing the different environment we're in. So with that, just don't want there to be sort of any surprises, or just want to make sure we're communicating as much as possible about things that we're considering, and welcome everyone's feedback on that. We do have our public testimony this evening at 6 p.m. That can be a little more casual, Representative Tallarico again. Mr. Ruggiero, again, is here through Saturday morning. This afternoon, actually going to the Senate Resources Committee on a data transparency bill. So if individuals are interested in learning more on that, they start at 3:30, and then I think around 4 o'clock is when you're up. And then through Senator Stevens' office, who coordinates the LBNA contracts, please get in touch. And, you know, if you have other questions, that's while he's still enjoying while he and Christine are still enjoying the snow, the Texans enjoying the snow while they're here in town with us. So thank you, everyone, and we'll see you at 6 o'clock. We're adjourned at 2:41.